Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Ask Tall Paul radio show. This is Tall Paul coming to you live from San Marcos, California. Today we have a very special guest, Christopher Schein. He's the author The Vegetable Gardener's Guide to Permaculture, Creating an Edible Ecosystem. Christopher, welcome. How are you today?
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, I'll tell you, last night I had a very rare treat. I got to meet in person. You've been on a tour giving a lecture about creating edible ecosystems. And we had a full house at Tipuana Farm, which is a permaculture demonstration site in San Marcos, California. And, I mean, the comments I heard, people were very inspired and very grateful for you to come out and, you know, teach us about permaculture. And, you know, I just really wanted to thank you for being on the show today. And I'm just very thrilled to, you know, be able to have you here today. So tell us about your background and what inspired you to write your book.
Yeah, thanks. I've been mainly an urban gardener for the past 20 years in Oakland and Berkeley up in the Bay Area. And I, 20 years ago, came across some of the permaculture books out there and just got very inspired of how to do it. I had, in college, I went to UC Santa Cruz, and they have a wonderful 45-year-old plus agroecology garden. So it's not exactly permaculture, but wonderful folks growing their own food on a huge scale and teaching people, and very inspiring, of all these fruit trees. And that was the first place where I really saw comfrey as an understory and all these lovely flowers they had and tons of vegetables and herbs. And so that's really where I got inspired. And I was a work study student to put myself through school. And I was taking the compost scraps from the local cafeterias and bringing it to the farm. So that's really my entry. Soil is really where it always comes from in a sustainable agriculture system. So I literally came into sustainable agriculture from the ground up. And when I was in Santa Cruz, I studied radical social movements doing an American Studies degree. So I didn't really study permaculture. And I found this program in Detroit while I was a student there in 1992 called Detroit Summer. And so it brought me back to my roots, because I grew up in Ann Arbor in Michigan, and brought me back to the Midwest for the summer. And we had about 25 college students from around the country coming into Detroit, as you probably well know, a post-industrial city with a lot of problems, 65,000 vacant homes, 30,000 vacant lots, just a lot of opportunity for a permaculture kind of inspired organizing. And so we worked with about 20 local high school kids and all these nonprofits that were doing house renovations and community gardening and water quality monitoring, because there's still people fishing in the Detroit River, painting community murals, so all this kind of social justice activism with young people trying to revision their city. So that was really a big inspiration. And I met some folks that were doing some permaculture there. And so that was really neat. And I ended up writing my senior thesis about it and being inspired by Detroit Summer, and managed to get back 4 summers in a row and bring the work to Oakland, California, which is not as hard to hit economically as Detroit, but still has quite a few vacant lots and quite a large bit of unemployment, and just needing to change our whole system. You know, like nowadays we have something like 30 million acres of lawns, just, you know, green cancer, just all this energy going into strictly ornamental stuff. So permaculture is, you know, really about earth care, people care, and fair share. And after doing the Detroit stuff and being a student at Santa Cruz, I spent 3 years in Oakland and Berkeley setting up about a dozen community gardens with this group called Spiral Gardens. And then I felt like I needed some more training, so I found this program in British Columbia called Linnea Farm. And they have a 8-month-long permaculture design course with Liz Richardson and Brent Howie. That's just one day a week doing permaculture. And they're on a 300-acre land trust with 30 acres of pasture with you know, beef cows and dairy cows and turkeys and pigs and chickens and all that kind of stuff on a pretty big scale, and an acre production vegetable garden that the students maintain, and then an acre student garden where 2 half-days a week we got to do whatever we wanted. So it was a really wonderful opportunity to learn natural building and agroecology and permaculture all together, agroforestry, just learn all these things, native plants, all this wonderful stuff in a really concise form, very intense, with a great library. Anyway, so I brought that kind of information from British Columbia, Cortez Island, really lovely, idyllic place, back to the city, and kind of been teaching permaculture ever since. About 11 years ago, I got invited to teach permaculture at the community college in Oakland at Merritt College. So we have an acre food forest, and we have had, I don't know exactly, but roughly 800 students who've come through the program, and I'm learning all the time from the students, and we're always pushing the envelope and diversifying, and you know, we just have a very fun, evolving food forest. So that's what I do part-time, and then the other time I'm also doing my own edible and native landscape company where I do some rainwater and gray water and lots of mulching and growing lots of food, restoring ecosystems 1 yard at a time, where I also do some school gardens or community gardens. I do some volunteering in some places and help maintain some homeless gardens and demonstration ecological gardens for nonprofits. And so do a lot of small different things and kind of piece it all together to make something full-time as well as teaching. And so, that's what I do in a nutshell.
Well, I mean, my gosh, just what you've already said is so inspiring. And you're a leader, you're definitely on the cutting edge, and you're helping to form future leaders in the permaculture world. And, you know, this is why, you know, I want to help promote you, and I want people to, you know, hear from you, because you have this spark and a passion that we need more of out there. And so I know that, I know last night you mentioned that you worked even with some people that were, you know, where you live, you called it like a permaculture, a food desert.
Right.
Yeah. And you've even worked with people that have been in prisons, and, you know, it's mm-hmm. kind of helped them to turn their life around, living closer to the land and, you know, getting out in a peaceful environment, and just, you know, really neat. So we talked about a food forest. Tell us a little bit more about that and how someone in an urban environment can actually, you know, go about that, and or maybe give us 3 things that people could do to get started.
Sure. So a food forest is a bigger concept that maybe you don't have enough space for it, or it might be a little bit complicated, but there's basically, the way we talk about it in the book, is an 8-layered food forest. And so you start with the overstory of a large canopy species. They could be nitrogen-fixing trees, or they could just be a large fruit tree on standard rootstock, so very large trees to the north of the site usually. Then the next layer down would be the small tree layer, so it could be a dwarf or semi-dwarf fruit tree or smaller species of a nitrogen fixer. Then the next layer down would be the shrub layer, so something that's a woody perennial like a blueberry or raspberries could be some example, or other nitrogen fixers, because they're pulling atmospheric nitrogen and putting it into the soil, so we're building soil all the time. Then the next layer down in the food forest would be the herb layer, and that's something that's an herbaceous perennial or annual. So here it could be culinary herbs, medicinal herbs. It could be things that are nutrient accumulators, things that ferry up nutrients deep in the soil and make it available to the other plants. Again, smaller nitrogen fixers, but it's like a fava bean or something like that. And then, of course, there's all the vegetables in the herb layer, because here we're thinking about herbs in the sense of an ecological context. So any plant that dies back, basically, that's relatively small. So pretty much most of your vegetables can fit in the herb layer, annual vegetables and perennial vegetables like sunchokes or rhubarb or asparagus. Those are some classic perennial vegetables. But there's a whole bunch of other perennial vegetables too. But anyway, things that die back that don't have year-round woody stems would be in the herb layer. And then the next layer down would be the root layer, so plants that also bring nutrients up, but things that we can eat. or things that just help out the ecosystem. So we could think of carrots or parsnips or daikon. And I like to talk about daikon because it's a really great plant that has a deep taproot that can actually start tilling the soil for you over time. It's got a really strong taproot that can punch channels in the soil and create air passages for the other plants to have an easier time for growing. So we want to think about the root layer as an important thing not to be forgotten, even though you don't see the plants growing, but that's pretty much an essential part of a food forest. And then a ground cover would be another part of the food forest layer, so something that's just going to hold the soil. And in some cases, you could use strawberries as a great example, and something that we can eat. But it could even be a squash plant, or it could be a ceanothus that's a ground cover species, or there's dwarf coyote brush that are dwarf species. So it could be stuff that's more for the birds and the bees, so to say, or building soil. So but anyway, just protecting the soil so we don't have it drying, we don't have it eroding. We don't have weeds that we don't want coming in, so we kind of stack our garden systems with the plants that are beneficial to us and the ecology, and not the invasive star thistles of the world that are no fun to walk on and get poked on and things like that that we don't really want in our garden so much. So the ground cover is a really important layer. And then we want to go back up in the food forest and hit the vine layer. So kiwis, grapes, those kind of perennials are things that can go upward. So you need a strong trellis or a fence, or say there's a column on your building or some kind of thing you want to screen out. So those species I mentioned before, kiwis and grapes, are deciduous, so they drop their leaves. So if you put them to the south or the west where you're getting a bunch of intense heat, you can create a shade canopy during the summer months. And during the winter months, they've dropped their leaves and let in that light to help warm up your buildings. So the vine layer is really good just for growing up in a small space. And then the last layer, the eighth layer in the food forest, becomes the mushroom layer, the fungi layer. And here you can grow stuff under the other plants because mushrooms don't need light, and they break down all this organic matter you're putting in your food forest because you're extensively mulching tons and tons of wood chips you get from an arborist and put down, you know, 12 inches of mulch in your paths just to start. And then within a month, it drops to 6 inches. And within a couple of months, it's 4 inches. It just keeps the soil food web that you reinvigorate, you jump start, just starts eating up the organic matter you're putting in. And so each year you put down more wood chips just to boost soil fertility and act as a giant sponge to hold in moisture. And then if you integrate edible mushroom species, like oyster mushrooms or shiitakes, then you can go even further and get mushrooms that you can eat out of the food forest. So that's a really wonderful benefit of the fungi layer, and just makes compost.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. And in their book, and it explains this, and the focus, you know, is, you know, to help people to break it down, make it easier, because, you know, you've been doing it for so long, it's probably come second nature. But, you know, I absolutely recommend the book because it can help the everyday person get started and to learn about how these systems, you know, permaculture is a design science. And as you go along, you learn, you know, you look at your environment. And so can you explain, like, if someone has a house and how they first start going about, you know, perhaps surveying their property to figure out what they should do?
Yeah, I'll tell a little story about my own garden that definitely is a feature in the book, as I do highlight other gardens as well and other strategies, but just some mistakes you want to try to avoid. One of the principles in permaculture is to observe and interact. So we want to really check out what's going on multiple levels. In permaculture, we call doing this kind of thing as you need to kind of make a sector analysis. So you got to see where your wild energies are coming in, things that could be beyond your influence, like where would a winter frost, where would it be settling on your land? So you don't try to put tender perennials that will get killed there. So doing a lot of observation, and early on you can plant lots of, say, nasturtiums or something that can just be a big ground cover, and then you can observe where the nasturtiums are going to be surviving the winter frost and where they're going to be dying. And then that's kind of a way to do a sketch up of where's the frost pocket. So you just have some plants and see what's going to make it and what's not. So that's just one thing about wild energies. Another one would be about where would fires be coming from? Because, you know, you don't want your property to burn up. You don't want your house to burn down. And so you want to be able to plant some things to block it, or just have cisterns and ponds and dams and whatnot, accessible roads so you can fight the fires and things like that. So you just got to really plan on the much bigger things. So you're planning for disaster, and you're planning on where the deer might be coming in, or are there gophers, or where is it intensely sunny and where is it shady and things like that. So just the wild energies, or where is there a beautiful view, or where is there an ugly view, just the things that you want to design around. So those are some bigger things. And then around my garden, I moved in about 6.5 years ago, and the prior owners had put the vegetable garden about 75 feet from the house in a bright green big lawn with some ornamental shade trees, and they did a typical conventional landscape idea of, you know, three raised beds in the far back of the garden, thinking that vegetables are kind of messy, and they put in an ornamental flower border that happened to have a few medicinal plants in there, like Echinacea purpurea. So in that kind of system, what we did is we looked at it, and I had the just did the observation and realized that, you know, it wasn't a very functional garden design, because you had to walk really far to get the vegetables. Say it's raining, it's cold, or you're working all day and you come home and you're feeling kind of tired. It's easier just to open up the fridge, or, you know, having gone to the grocery store or the farmer's market on your way home, than to go to that 75-foot little walk to the vegetables. So we like to say that permaculture is about good common sense. So that wasn't really a good common sense place to put your vegetables, because you want them so you can get them right off your doorstep. You want them so they're really easy to access, so you're on it. So you can do some snail control or whatever you need to do, water those little tender baby seedlings when they're just going in, that kind of stuff. So anyway, we flipped it all around, and I was able to I was living somewhere else, and my girlfriend at the time owned the house, and I was able just to see where was it flooding, which ornamental trees did I want to take out, you know, how did I want to change it up. So it's kind of, I had a whole year to really dream it up before I did anything other than just simple maintenance. And then we got married, and I moved in. We have two lovely daughters, and so now I'm really committed to this site. But I had that opportunity to just observe before I did anything too drastic. And then as soon as I moved in, I cut down many of the ornamental, just about all the ornamental shade trees. We sheet mulched the grass lawn, put in raised beds out of the ornamental trees to border the beds, tons of sheet mulch, tons of wood chips to smother the grass, and compost for the vegetable beds and fruit orchard that we made, the whole food forest. And, you know, just not having the vegetables in the back of the yard was another thing, that it only got about 6 months of adequate sun to grow vegetables back there, because there's some surrounding buildings that the prior people hadn't really considered. So they missed out on a good 6 months of growing, because there's two-story buildings that shaded out the tucked away corner of the garden vegetables. So we brought that to the center of the garden, and all over the garden, the vegetables and fruit trees, where they get 12 months of light, and it does much better. We put the chicken coop and the compost pile in that back corner, because they don't need as much light. And, you know, a long 75-foot chicken run where there's bamboo shading out some of those two-story buildings. So we've just integrated some things, you know, chickens and ducks, a couple of beehives, full compost systems, humanure, and just regular compost systems, 1,000 gallons of rainwater. The whole garden has had about 90 or 95 yards of wood chips in the 6.5 years spread throughout the whole entire property. And each year the wood chips just kind of get digested by the soil food web, and it makes beautiful soil. And so in the first year of the garden, I had about 11 yards of wood chips, 11 yards of compost that we brought in, just to jumpstart the vegetable beds and the fruit orchards and the bamboo plantings and stuff. And now I export easily 5 yards of compost that we make from local restaurant waste from my landscaping business. I'll bring in a half a truckload of, you know, weedy greens that the chickens and ducks will eat, and that kind of stuff. So I'm actively making compost. The arbors drop off, you know, 15 yards on average a year of wood chips, and I put that in the paths, and that breaks down, and I can harvest that after a couple of years. So just
how large is your property? Is it just a standard home in your area? Or?
It is. It is. The backyard, so there's the front yard is to the, there's a small garden in the front where we grow natives, but it's mainly to the north side of the house. So we grow some nice stuff there, but it's not really where I put my energy into growing the vegetables and food. So to the backyard, it happens to be to the south. So in my climate in Berkeley, it works really great. We want to maximize the sun. I realize here it's a lot hotter and you want to create more shade. Our backyard is 40 feet wide by 75 feet long, and it includes a little straw bale casita where our nanny lives. And so we do a great work trade where she watches our kids for 10 hours a week. She gets to live there in this little, very small studio with a little outdoor kitchen and outdoor shower and really nice little kind of retreat space. The chickens and ducks, the rainwater tanks, the bees, the compost systems, and all this food forest stuff. So, it's 3,000 square feet where we're growing lots of food. And we don't claim to grow 100% of our food. That's not the goal of permaculture on a scale like that. I mean, if I had acreage, I'd like to grow more of my food. But you grow what you can well and with minimal effort. And then you share it and you trade it and you give it away, and I sell some of my eggs to pay for some of the feed costs and things like that. So it's a small space relatively, but we've gone up, we've gone out. You know, sometimes when I have a little more time, I've been able to trellis the pumpkins on top of the casita, the little straw bale house, and use the roof space for growing pumpkins. So it just takes a little management, but you can really maximize a lot of food out of a food forest with not too much effort.
That's awesome. I mean, it sounds like paradise to me, if you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is you said you learn as you go. Like you put the tomatoes in one area and then you move them, or you know, as you every year when I am in my garden, I learn new things and I discover, you know, those different patterns within my environment. And I think that's a good message for people to know, that don't worry about, you know, you don't have to be perfect. Just get started mm-hmm. and do it. And that way you can add these systems as you go, like water harvesting and, you know, energy conservation, other things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I did not, Rome was not built in a day, as they say, right? So, I certainly didn't get all my systems in right away. I've been layering it in. We certainly did the sheet mulching and starting all the fruit trees because that's going to take the longest. And, you know, it took us a year to work on and off on the straw bale building. And, you know, just in a workshop, we built the bamboo chicken coop. And then the next year, we started the rainwater tanks. And then we have a pretty extensive gray water system. And so one year, we did a workshop and put in the shower upstairs onto the gray water system. And then later, we did another part of a second shower in the house, you know, and that kind of thing, where it doesn't all have to be done at once. You just have to have the grandiose vision on you're trying to close all loops and have no waste and have everything turn back on itself. So the water goes to water the bamboo, and then the bamboo is used to feed the chickens the leaves and create habitat for them. And the bamboo is I make fences for my landscaping business out of it, or we built the chicken coop or a trellis for the tomatoes or something. So we're able to harvest a lot of bamboo wood for garden projects, that kind of stuff.
That is great. Now, in last night in your presentation, you had some slides, and you know, I noticed you had your children out in the garden. Tell us, you know, how old are they, and are they aware of what's going on? And I mean, because when I was raised, I had no experience, no exposure at all to any sort of food production, and you know, even in the garden. So it's mm-hmm. Beautiful to see. And you made a comment that, you know, someday that your children will be able to feed you. You're feeding them now, but someday they'll be able to feed you or something to that extent.
Yeah, that's the dream and the vision. I was fortunate enough to have my mother get me into gardening, and she had a small vegetable garden plot off the back doorsteps within a very small townhouse situation with not a large garden, and she did extensive flower gardening around the immediate couple of houses and stuff, so she was pretty major gardener. And so that was an influence that's just what she did for her hobby, and she loved to do it, and it was fun to pick the food. And then there was even a community garden in our neighborhood when I was growing up, for not my whole youth, but I remember doing it for a few years on and off, and helping out and just, you know, getting really inspired that we could certainly come together and convert some lawn into some food production and do it in a community-based way. So I got that exposure as a kid, and I didn't realize the influence it had on me, but this is what I'm doing with my life. So it certainly was profound, just being connected to the natural world. Being near some large woods to run around into also was a great help. And so, yeah, having my daughters come and help. So the older daughter, Gitanjali, will be 6 in September. And so it's really nice to have her be involved with it. And she likes to plant, and she likes to harvest, and she likes to pull weeds. And there's hardly any weeds in my garden, so she gets quite excited when a volunteer squash comes up and, you know, can pull it out. But anyway, she does some school gardening in her public school, John Muir Elementary School, so she's able to teach other people. I remember very recently for her cousins who live in Oakland, for their birthdays, we gave them a raised bed, because they just had moved into a new place, and, you know, put in some vegetables and whatnot. And so Gitanjali was able to show the other kids how to really plant already. So she's like, you know, here's how you do it, and was kind of took the lead of that. So it's pretty fun that in the right situation, she can do that. And the other one is Bija Sol, and she's just under 2. She's not old enough yet to figure out. She just kind of pulls everything, so I have to keep an eye on her. But I have a feeling she's going to be a really hard worker when she's older. So
good, yeah. Well, and I love, you know, that your daughter's already a leader, and that's really what I would like to do, is identify these leaders and help to promote them. And I absolutely, you know, as I said before, you are a leader, and so. You know, you work with so many people, and you're influencing them. You work in a college environment where you have people, you know, coming to learn and all this. How can people that aren't involved yet, how can they get involved and learn about this permaculture?
Yeah, in the book I have a little section on the end about permaculture and community, and so you really have to just plug into your local community in whatever scale you're at. So it might be through a church garden that's really something that's taking off on a big scale of churches realizing there's more and more inequality and they want to do something about it, and churches traditionally have some land around their churches and, you know, a bunch of church members, right, that are their congregation, that so they have a lot of people involved, and so they want to give back to the community. And so there's quite a few church gardens where they're growing for soup kitchens and food banks and things like that. I'm seeing more and more of them, and I'm pretty excited by it. I think it's a really great direction. So for those that are of a church, you know, just advocate for that, or maybe it's already existing or things like that. And so then other people, you can plug into this kind of stuff through a school garden. Tons of school gardens are popping up everywhere. You know, in Berkeley we have the Edible Schoolyard with Alice Waters, so we have a whole acre student garden that's just fabulous, where they have 5 chefs. It's pretty off the hook, and 3 full-time gardeners, and, you know, 800 kids that work on this garden together. So it's just a booming garden. Anyway, so, you know, look into school gardens. Look into community gardens, and community gardens are a great way to start learning about this stuff, because someone might have more experience than you, and you can kind of have some of their knowledge rub off on you, and they would like to show you what they have, or give you some extra seedlings or cuttings. Or, you know, when you grow a flat of broccoli and you only have a small garden plot, you can't possibly put them all in, and so people get really good at sharing, and people that are doing this kind of stuff because they're passionate about something, or they have kind of some species, some specimen or whatever, they're like, yes, you must have this tree collard. And so then they propagate it in their backyard and give you the cuttings to take to yourself. So there's any number of ways to get involved with this. I have a little section about doing a community food assessment. So you start going around your neighborhood and knocking on doors and trying to assess where do you see the fruit trees, especially in the springtime is a good time to identify when you know, the plums are in blossom or the apples are in blossom or things like that. You can say, hey, there's a potential fruit tree, so make a note of it as you're walking around your neighborhood, and then come back later in the summer when the fruit might be ripe, and you know, maybe there's an elder that can't harvest it, or maybe there's a very full-time working parent that is just overwhelmed, and knock on the door and, hey, can I help pick that fruit and give them some and take some for yourself and take some to the food bank. So there's any number of ways to get involved in a local resilient food system, and then you can also start your own stuff if there's not something existing. So that's why I suggest doing a community food audit. So if you are in a food desert, you can change that. You know, you can start having farmers markets come in to places where they're not. There's a lot of local hospitals that have gotten on board of the farmers market thing. Kaiser up in the Bay Area, I know Kaiser's in multiple states, but they host farmers markets because they've realized through some great community advocacy that if we have farmers markets in low-income neighborhoods, then their patients will be healthier. And so doctors have actually started whole obesity clinics in Oakland for kids. It's just quite amazing that we even have that problem. But still, they get the kids to be exposed to food growing, and then they get their parents to be able to go to a farmer's market in a neighborhood that didn't have a farmer's market, so they can make the connections to the farmers, get organic produce out there, and the hospitals subsidize the price in some neighborhoods of the farmer's markets, so more people will use it. And then they even, at Children's Hospital in Oakland, some of the doctors give subsidized, I don't know what it's called exactly, but they basically give a patient a ticket so they could go into the farmer's market and get free food. So they realize that people's diet and nutrition is just so horrible. They're just reliant on liquor stores and whatnot for their calories. So they're getting people food in a great way. So there's just so many different levels where people are reconnecting. You know, farmer's markets are just mushrooming everywhere. So that's a, you know, good way. And then there's tons of permaculture training centers, and on this 9-day book tour, I'm finding that, you know, UC Santa Cruz is starting to have a permaculture class, and Cabrillo College and Aptos, the next town over from up there, is having a permaculture class, and Santa Barbara has their community college has permaculture courses, and I met some practitioners of permaculture from Slow Permaculture, San Luis Obispo Permaculture. They're teaching a weekend kind of permaculture class. So it's really catching on. So these ideas are not just about growing food. It's about growing community. And in LA, I just saw Larry Santoyo. He's an expert permaculture teacher for a very long time and really getting folks in LA to figure out food growing and water harvesting and all kinds of things, because permaculture is much bigger than just food growing, but that's where I fit in. So that's what I'm talking about. But other people do other things, and you know, there's natural building, and there's all kinds of things that come out of permaculture, and just community structures that people are working on with permaculture models. So it's really getting a lot bigger, and yeah, it's been nice that, you know, I started doing it about 20 years ago, and it was always such an uphill battle to and have to have that elevator speech for permaculture. And it's tough because it's much more than just one thing. Permaculture is just such a complicated, wonderful thing, you know, about applied ecology, about good common sense. One of the founders, David Holmgren, talks about permaculture when he was developing it back in the 70s in Australia with Bill Mollison, that they were looking of how could they combine three separate fields of landscape, so just our built environment around where we live. That's where we need to put a lot of energy, and that's not traditionally been very sustainable. You know, there's lawns and palm trees and whatnot, just stuff that we can't really eat is kind of what people put around their homes, and then rely on corporate industrial agriculture to feed us, and it's just so not sustainable for the 1,500 mile food coming in, the food miles that we have. So they're looking at the landscape, and then they're also wanting to look at agriculture, of course, just the unsustainable agriculture system. How can we have a sustainable agriculture? So they came up with permanent agriculture, or permaculture, and then since then, permaculture is also going on to mean permanent culture, so much larger issues than just our food. It's everything that needs to be sustainable. And so the third field that David Holmgren was wanting to integrate in permaculture was ecology. Like, how do we do agriculture and landscapes ecologically, and how do we think about the butterflies and the bees and the birds and, you know, just everything in our ecosystem, so we're not just growing our food systems just for us, because that's been kind of the hard thing about going on this this road trip and just seeing the scale and the destruction, and just, it's very efficient, the industrial agriculture, but you'll see, like in Watsonville, just miles and miles of strawberries, and it's even, the fields are even leveled with lasers to be precise, and that's just not found in nature. And Bill Mollison likes to say that monocultures are maintained disorders, because it takes a lot of energy inputs from outside to keep them at the same rate that they are, to always keep them in wheat, or always keep them in strawberries, or always keep them in avocados, or just whatever, just one single species, and it's destructive to the environment, and it's destructive to the workers. You know, I saw those strawberry pickers, just, you know, thousands of people bent over picking strawberries, when strawberries are something pretty easy to grow in your backyard, or support a local farmer instead of having this kind of, like, you know, mass migrant labor stuff that we're needing. So we really don't want exploitation in our food systems. We don't want the food, the environment, or the people exploited. So we don't want GMOs. We don't want chemicals on our food, you know, because it's going to be chemicals on our bodies. It's chemicals on the workers. It's all these things. And we don't need a chemical-based agricultural system if we have polyculture, if we're planning for putting in some native yarrows, a hedgerow, or a butterfly bush, or whatever the plant is, depending on the scale of the project. But if you put in a yarrow, then you're going to be able to have parasitic wasps that come in, eat the pollen and nectar on that yarrow. It's a pretty plant that we just like as people. It's ornamental, so that works. And it's in the aster family, and so we know that there's little parasitoids or hoverflies that will come to it, and then they're going to move on once they're attracted to our garden and have a lunch buffet of aphids or white flies or scale or something. So we really need to reweave the web of life in our gardens. That's why it's the book is Creating an Edible Ecosystem. So it's much more than just growing food. So we have to grow food for us and for wildlife. We have to remember, too, that we are a part of nature no matter what we do, no matter how high our skyscrapers get. We were born of this planet. We are nature. We're a walking factory of, you know, all these bacteria, and all this stuff is part of us. We are nature, and we just got to remember that and make our gardens that remember that as well, so we're not in sterile moonscapes of single species with lots of chemical and water and nitrogen inputs. We can really grow a lot of it ourselves. We can't grow 100% of it ourselves. That's not what we're advocating, but we can do it in community, and we can have fun doing it, and we can learn. And like you said earlier, it's about learning from your mistakes. And so you start small and you build on from your successes.
Absolutely. And the one part that I've really enjoyed about it is the community aspect of it. And when you're designing, so like you might have land where you think, okay, I want to grow food for my family. I've always asked people to kind of broaden their vision a little bit, and you kind of touched on about it. As you're walking through your neighborhood and you see an apple tree or whatever, well, if you already have an apple tree in the neighborhood, you know, depending upon the size of it, I mean, it could feed a lot of people. Or like where I live, we have citrus galore. Everyone's got an orange tree, a lemon mm-hmm. tree. And so rather than you planting an orange tree or lemon tree, find out what's not in the neighborhood. Because one of the three ethics, the one that's, you call it the fair share or return of surplus, that part can be built into the design. And so kind of, I always say, widen the scope of your focus and like, and use that second permaculture ethic, which is the care of people. How can I care for the other people in my neighborhood, my community? And so, but if you, I'd like to hear your point on the fair share, because I know that that's really not in people's mind. Everyone thinks this is mine, and you know, they it's always me. But when you realize that there's such an abundance, and once you start growing food, you don't realize how much of an abundance there can be until you start doing it. And for me, the part that I love is when I have this abundance, like I grow tomatoes. I don't even like tomatoes, but I love giving them away because people love tomatoes and they're expensive in the store.
Mm-hmm.
And or if you have an orange tree or whatever, you those oranges fall on the ground and you're just going to let them go to waste. And why not share them? For me, I've had so much joy in the community building that goes along with it. I love that. So talk to us about this fair share.
Yeah, the third ethic, you know, after earth care and people care. So we're taking care of our environment. We are part of our environment. And we're taking care of our communities, taking care of people, then we go on to the third ethic. And the third ethic can be kind of interesting because it's written in many different ways. It's definitely the more difficult principle because it's setting limits on consumption and population as the more lengthy, more academic version of it. And thankfully, they've figured out a better soundbite of fair share. Everybody getting an equal piece of the pie. My grandfather was a union organizer, and my grandmother was as well in Detroit. And they would talk about leveling the playing field because, you know, we have this massive inequality in our society, massive concentration of wealth and ownership around land and stuff. And so for me, permaculture's, the way I see it, is something moving towards land reform where we can break up these big monopolies and get more and more people on the land and more equitable distribution of our resources so everybody gets a fair share of the pie. And so in your garden scale, like you said, you get certain things that are just more than you can easily deal with and you want to start sharing. It's just an innate thing about a garden, so we want to get away from industrial ag, which is not about sharing at all, but go more towards the horticulture where people are gardening and seeing how much abundance they can easily make and sharing it. So one nice example we have in the Bay Area through the Transition Town movement, they started some crop swaps. It's an international movement, Transition Towns, but the idea of a crop swap is that either on a during the peak season of harvest, it might be weekly, or during the winter months, it might be a monthly basis. But anyway, you get together in some kind of community center or community public space, so we do some reclaiming the commons, so it might even be outside of a public library or something, but anywhere you can get people together, or outside of a church or something, you set up some bunch of tables and we organize a bunch of gardeners, and you know, we get sometimes 40 people that get together and they trade extra zucchinis and tomatoes and lettuce and carrots and honey and you know, whatnot, just all eggs from chickens, all that kind of stuff. People have an abundance and want to share it. They're happy to share it because you know, that's what a productive permaculture garden or any kind of garden is really about. And then we redistribute the surplus that we have from our systems, and so we can diversify it. So if you love to grow tomatoes and you grow them well, someone might have tomatillos, like, oh, that's really great, or Cape gooseberries or something that's different that you're not growing that you might want to start growing, or you see, wow, they're doing it so well. This person has a cherimoya, and I have a Valencia orange. I don't know what type you have, but you know, you have something in abundance, and then you're able to diversify your yields by sharing it, and it makes for a lot less work, and it makes for a fun social gathering to basically not need the corporate agricultural system as much. You know, we're not going to totally compost it overnight, but that is my goal, to have different alternative structures to our present destructive agricultural systems, and we're going to do it on a community level. So yeah, I think fair share is really what sets permaculture apart from other systems. But in permaculture, we're not like against any other thing in the sense of whatever, there's like biodynamics or biointensive or anyway. So yeah, fair share is just really, really essential.
It is, and it's very exciting. We're coming to the end of the show now, and I just wanted to thank you again. Tell us what website people should go to visit to learn more about your book and the other projects you're working on.
Sure. WildHeartGardens.com is my gardening business, and so I'm promoting the book. So it's got a more extensive resource page on it, and you know, websites to go from for the work we do at Merritt College, merrittlandhort.com. merrittlandscape.com, short for Merritt Landscape Horticulture. Both sites have some great student-made videos about my backyard garden or about the food forest at Merritt. That's a really good one. There's a seed library that helps start Basil Bay Area Seed Interchange Library, and the website is through ecologycenter.org, and richmondgrowsseeds.org has a template on how to start your own seed library, so a community way to share seeds. So those are my favorite websites to share.
Wonderful. Well, I'd love to invite you back anytime you'd like to speak, and because I know you have, you know, a wealth of information, and you know, you're so inspiring, and it's just, we need more Christopher Shines out there, because you know, we need exposure to people who have a passion in this knowledge, and you're helping to do that with your teaching and sharing of this book. And, you know, I love you for that, and I thank you for being here. And, you know, let me know how I can help.
All right. Well, Ben, thanks so much for having me on.
All right. Thanks, Christopher.
Take care. Bye-bye.